It was one of the hits of 1961, and it caught, perfectly yet discreetly, the prevailing sexual mores. In the Shirelles' Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, the singer seems to be contemplating sex with a boyfriend, and she wishes reassurance that she's loved for herself and not just for her body. She knows not to nag, but is aware that men can feel differently in the morning. I know it was always thus, but it was more so in 1961. Girls gave themselves for love, and boys fell in love in order to be given girls. We recognize in the Shirelles' plaintive cry a version of that need for reassurance also sought by the philosophers. How can we be sure that the future will resemble the past? Can we be entirely confident that the sun will rise tomorrow? The Shirelles knew that it would. I love when the night meets the morning sun. But their emotional and epistemological angst moves me in a way that mere philosophy never could. Of course, none of this had occurred to me in my final year of high school. Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow was just one of a number of good songs, slow and smoochy, that made life sweet. No, I didn't start to think like this until 1962, during my freshman year at the University of Pennsylvania, of Philosophy 101, Rationalism and Empiricism. I'd done some philosophy with dear Miss Wyeth, read the ancients, some Montaigne and Erasmus, monkeyed about with the major philosophical questions regarding goodness or the existence of God. So unlike many first-year philosophy students, I was neither in search of the meaning of life nor signing up to study a set of works through which I might improve myself. No, I knew that philosophy was abstract, logical, rigorous and impersonal, and would contrast sharply with my courses in English. I adored Descartes' Meditations. He began by suggesting that nothing should be taken as knowledge unless it was beyond any imaginable doubt. He would, he suggested, we joined him, doubt universally. And not only would we do that, we would also imagine that an omnipotent being, malign rather than beneficent, had made it his project to make us believe what was not the case. I'm eating an orange? How do I know that? Could my senses deceive me? Might I be dreaming? Might that miserable imp, the malevolent demon, be fooling me in some way, perhaps with an apple that looks and tastes like an orange? Anyway, was there really any me that could feel and taste and come to a conclusion? Perhaps I was not dreaming myself. Perhaps I was a phantom in someone else's dream. Nevertheless, Descartes maintains, there's something left, even in this miasma of doubt, and that is the fact that some thinking is going on, and the I who is thinking is myself. The fact that I'm thinking means that I must exist. In the classic formulation, I think, therefore I am. Now, that was fun. That was terrific. It didn't matter that there was clearly something wrong with the argument, because all that the perceived thinking can really establish is the conclusion some thinking is going on, and not that there is some I, much less me, who is doing it. Because I liked the method every bit as much as the conclusion. I love doubting in the way that fanatical believers adore God. I felt the soul of Holden Caulfield stirring, newly animated, as if he'd come to college with me. We both felt free at last. Now it wasn't people that were phony, but ideas and beliefs. I found myself moving from the kinetic, bulky opposition of my high school attitudes to something more powerful and more satisfying. But if I'd been stimulated by reading Descartes, I was absolutely bowled over by first reading David Hume's An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, which took Cartesian doubt to a new level by holding up unconsidered basic truths to skeptical analysis. Bertrand Russell described the method perfectly. The point of philosophy, he said, is to start with something so simple as not to seem worth stating, and to end with something so paradoxical that no one will believe it. Thus, Hume begins with the unarresting observation that if you hit a white billiard ball into a red one, the red one will carom away. And he ends with the absolutely startling conclusion that there is nothing incontrovertibly necessary about this effect. In his words, motion in the second billiard ball is a quite distinct event from the motion in the first, nor is there anything in the one to suggest the smallest hint of the other. It's no overstatement to say that such arguments and considerations radically altered the way in which I saw, engaged with, and described the world. I walked about campus lost in a fog of speculation like a reincarnated medieval cleric. What if a woman were to give birth to a fish? Or an apple ascend after leaving the tree? Why should they not do so? This had inevitable emotional consequences. One Saturday afternoon, after my girlfriend Rachel and I had rather enjoyed ourselves in bed, she nestled her head into my shoulder to ask if I would always love her. At that very moment, it seemed inconceivable that I would not, but I nevertheless gave the question the due consideration that it was so obviously not expected to prompt. "I don't see how I could say that," I said. Her head popped up, tears pooling in her eyes. "Why not? What's the matter?" "It simply isn't the sort of thing you can be certain of, is it?" I asked in that irritating, pompous voice that I was starting to adopt for academic disputation, and still do. "Is there somebody else?" she asked. "Certainly not. What a misunderstanding." I explained Hume's arguments on induction to her, certain that this would clarify why it was that I could not, with any philosophical integrity, promise that which could not be guaranteed. She listened carefully, and at the end of my disquisition, she stood up and started to dress. "I think we should go to dinner now," she said. "I'm getting hungry." The subject was never mentioned again, nor did she again inquire if I would still love her tomorrow. A girl raised on the Shirelles knows not to nag. She was a bit standoffish for a while, but I knew women could be irrational. No wonder there were no women philosophers. But I was already recognizing that philosophy was simply too hard for me. Once I'd read the major philosophers, it was clear that, one, they were a lot smarter than me, and two, I could hardly even follow some of their thinking. Philosophy, like maths or physics, tests and defines the limits of our understanding and our intelligence. You know what you can't do when you study philosophy. But such self-knowledge is by no means a wholly positive thing. If philosophy has the capacity to make you humble, it can also supply you with the tools to mask your shortcomings with quite extraordinary aggression. I did courses in symbolic logic, ethics and aesthetics, metaphysics, and the philosophy of science. I read widely. In both the primary and secondary literature, I honed my academic skills. Honing is a dangerous metaphor here, for in general, we are rightly anxious about immature people with knives. You can sharpen a scalpel or a butcher's knife and achieve marvels of accurate surgery upon the living or the dead. But offer a knife, even worse, a badly honed one, to someone without the skills or the sense to know how to use it, and quite a lot of misdirected slashing is likely to result. I became even more pedantic and argumentative. I scorned sloppy reasoning and crass induction. I demanded that my interlocutors define their terms. Your average person, I was fond of remarking, is quite incapable of distinguishing an argument from an assertion. And since it must be the case, both empirically and philosophically, that some people are right more often than others, I happily assimilated myself to the first category and waged a kind of tacit war on those in the latter. My ex-wife and children will testify to the effects of this and the kind of everyday bullying that it can engender. In short, I was quickly becoming the sort of person who wants to be a university teacher, but not a teacher of philosophy. There struck me as something arid and inconsequential in much philosophical discourse. Albert Einstein once remarked that when I study philosophical works, I feel I am swallowing something which I don't have in my mouth. I could not imagine feeling this way about the reading of literature, and it was eventually an easy decision for me to major in English rather than in philosophy. If one could imagine a mindset antithetical to Allen Ginsberg's inclusiveness and generosity, academic philosophy was it. I could see already there was something of a conflict between the two disciplines, between skepticism and imagination, which I had initially experienced as the Holden voice versus the Allen voice. Yet the fields had more in common than the easy academic distinctions between them might lead one to believe. Philosophers, as well as imaginative writers, have to find just the right language to convince their readers. Both attempt to locate and to uncover the nature of what is important, be it goodness or truth or beauty. 4 years later, I began applying for admission to graduate schools to do a PhD in English. Mostly, they were happy to have me, except for Yale University, and that, I suppose, was my own fault. The Yale application form demanded both that one sent in a sustained essay on a literary topic, I submitted one of my better course papers, and further that you had to write an essay of up to 1,000 words assessing your prospects as a graduate student at Yale. And this seemed to me an absolutely idiotic requirement. They already had my transcript of grades and courses taken, 3 recommendations from my tutors, and my course essay. Was one supposed to be honest in writing such self-description, citing one's strengths and weaknesses like a penitent on a pilgrimage? No thanks. My eventual submission of up to 1,000 words read as follows. My prospects as a graduate student at Yale University are uniformly excellent. Given a choice between affirming the sensibleness of their requirements and accepting this renegade candidate, the Yale Graduate Admissions Department chose the former and rejected the latter. I never much wanted to go there anyway. It was kind of too preppy for me. And I went to Oxford instead to read the newly fashionable BPhil degree in English. I loved that word, to read, which came from the Delegacy of English's handbook and was reiterated in the literature from Merton College, which had also advised that gentlemen are responsible for bringing their own tea crockery. My mother adored the phrase, and she used it repeatedly over the months before I left for Oxford. He's responsible for bringing his own tea crockery, you know, she told her friends. What's tea crockery? I don't know, she admitted, but I bought him a mug. I took it with me to Oxford, and it came in handy immediately when my next-door neighbor in the college graduate house at 21 Merton Street, Vijaya Samarawira, newly arrived from Ceylon, had an entire chestful of, who would have supposed it, tea in his possession. I showed him my mug. We became instant friends. Going to Oxford was the right decision. Great philosophy department, reasonable enough in English. I bought a Harris tweed jacket, a Merton scarf and tie, and had a 3-piece pinstripe suit made by Hall Brothers in the High. I had tea and apple crumble with custard at George's in the covered market, used jolly as an adjective, took afternoon tea in the middle common room, learned to call my tutor by his first name, went to evensong in the chapel, and joined the varsity tennis club. During the fixtures, you stopped for tea between matches. My fiancée Rachel, who still had a year to finish at college, would join me in Oxford the next year after our forthcoming marriage in June of 1967. What a great plan. You could count on love, whatever those skeptical Shirelles and that Mr. Hume suggested.